A few weeks ago, I gave a Dharma talk that was a way of describing non-self from a neuroscientific perspective. Neuroplasticity and non-self, I think, is the name of it. It's posted on the website. Tonight, the title of the talk is Neuroscience and the Four Noble Truths. Four Noble Truths, of course, is a basic concept, formative concept in Buddhism. Everything spins off of the Four Noble Truths. One of the truths is that there is no such thing as an enduring autonomous self. Anatta is the term. And that's been puzzling for people. It seems nihilistic or some kind of modem or excuse me moderation of reality. It's confusing. What it really means is that there's no one running the show inside. Everyone of us, every human being's experience is just a manifestation of the brain. The lungs function to move gases in and out of the body. The heart functions to move blood around the body. The brain functions to manage different systems and to think and feel. And that's a process that's impersonal. But the way our subjectivity operates, we think that there's a real person running the show, an ego that must be defended or gratified. So that's been very interesting for me lately, this understanding this concept of anatta or non-self. Tonight, I'm going to talk about the first three of the Four Noble Truths. To review them from a perspective of neuroscience, because that's one of the things that contemporary neuroscientific research does, is it kind of deconstructs the notion that there's a grand central station running the show in the brain, all these different dispersed neural networks that are interacting in extraordinarily complex ways all the time. One of the writers I respect said that, I'm paraphrasing, that we're energy transformative creatures. We take in energy in terms of food and oxygen, and it turns into behavior. But in the context of the mind, energy gets channeled into these complex neural pathways. And out of that complexity emerges myself. So this whole notion of Buddhism is not about destroying itself. It's about understanding the impersonality of selfing, so to speak. And there's a great benefit to that. I talked about that in terms of the neuroplasticity function in the brain. But I'm looking at my notes now. I do a lot of, I've got five pages of notes here for this. And they'll be posted on the website. And I really like to speak from my experience of having compiled the notes, reviewed them. I think I've covered what I wanted to say about preparing for this discussion. One more thing is that we can consider the brain as sort of like a hardware. And our selfing process is sort of like the software. Now, the thing that's interesting about humans is that through neuroplasticity, the hardware can transform the software. And that's where a whole notion of non-self comes into play as well. So, first, just a quick review of the Four Noble Truths. First is the truth of suffering. Life inevitably involves some kind of existential insecurity. We experience it emotionally as distress and cognitively as confusion. There are different levels of dukkha that are described in Buddhism. There's a dukkha dukkha, which is basically what happens when you buy a body. Aches and pains and aging and all the things, hunger, so forth and so on. Then there's sankhara dukkha. Sankhara dukkha basically involves the distress and confusion that comes about as a result of the greed, hatred, and ignorance, so to speak. I'll be talking more about that in a little bit. But what it functions, the way it functions is that the mind is making up itself as we go on, and it's an imperfect fit. It's a just good enough fit most of the time. So sankhara dukkha is really attending to that level of distress and confusion. And there's another level of dukkha, it's called viparinama dukkha. Classically, it's the distress and confusion that comes about as a result of loss of happiness. But the way I understand it is that it's the uncertainty of life, the best laid plans of mice and men, and so forth and so on. Often gang astray. So life is unpredictable and uncertain. Dukkha. The second noble truth is the cause of dukkha, which is craving, attachment, and ignorance. Now, I want to be talking about craving, attachment, and ignorance more neurologically in a few minutes. But craving is experienced as either the feeling of attraction or of repulsion because attachment to the view that there's an enduring autonomous self. So there's a feeling tone that every sentient creature has, but with humans, we experience it as emotions or affect. And affect basically means an orientation either toward more of a particular kind of experience, sensory or mental, or to avoid it, suppress it, get rid of it, maybe destroy it. So that's what affect is. We experience it as, we describe it as emotion. So there's this view that's emotionally loaded about the self. There's a self that's supposed to be in control, and there's a self that has to deal with whatever the hell happens, so to speak, good, bad, or indifferent. That's an essential part of dukkha. Ignorance is basically the inability to really investigate it, to be introspective, but non-attached, not to have an experience, an ongoing experience of self-inquiry that does not require defending or indulging that self-experience. It's hard to talk about because it's a very subtle thing. We're all immersed in it. It's sort of like a fish understanding that it's in fresh water and then it's put in salt water. It really doesn't understand what's going on, and you know it's immersed in it. It's sort of like what we're dealing with in terms of the origin of suffering. I call this self-state conflict. I'll be talking more about that later. Third noble truth is the cessation of suffering. It's possible that we can alleviate distress and confusion. That's what this training is all about. It requires a very careful and non-reactive investigation of how the process of selfing occurs. So that's countering ignorance. On one level, ignorance basically means not having information. On the other aspect, it's kind of delusional, ignoring, being distracted, so forth and so on. Being free of that is what the Third Noble Truth represents. And this freedom has different levels. Those of you who've been on retreats with me and Dharma talks, I talk about self-state conflict, self-state integration, and self-state liberation. We talk more about that a little later tonight. But self-state conflict is basically dukkha. And it's important to recognize characteristics of this conflict. We're conditioned to perceive ourselves in a certain way. The example that I use, I'm white and male, born right after World War II in the United States and raised in the South in a dysfunctional family system. If I had been born 10 years earlier or 10 years later, different skin color, different gender, different family system, different country, my self experience would be different. But it's because of the conditions that a person is born into that creates a certain kind of delusional process of self-identity. Because I was raised in the 50s and 60s and was eligible to go to Vietnam. And I refused to go. But there was a conflict there. Conflict for me. Should I be willing to fight or not? And I had to work through that. That's one example of self-state conflict. And of course, if I wasn't willing to go, I wasn't really a man. Right? And because I'm white, I get a lot of privileges that would not be so for people who were not white. And so forth and so on. So you get what I'm talking about. There's these causes and conditions that build a case for there being a self. But it's all fabricated. We're making it up as we go along. It's important to be able to investigate that and work through some resolution. And that's the Third Noble Truth. And there are different aspects of that or areas of integration with this practice. Self-state conflict is basically what I would call normal neurotic behavior. And the term for a neurotic is someone who builds castles in the sky but can't live in them. Psychotic is someone builds castles in the skies and lives in them. Right? So we're all kind of normal neurotics for the most part. And that neurosis comes about as a result of having this kind of ideal expectation of how we're supposed to be in the world. It doesn't always match up very well. And that's part of our challenge. And it's also part of our opportunity is to kind of sort that out, still be able to function socially. I mean, the Buddha had this transformative experience, nirvana, became a Buddha. And then went on to create a community and teach for another 40 years. Okay, this guy was no slouch, right? Very difficult times he did this. So, this notion of understanding selflessness, nirvana, experiencing it, does not mean that you can't function. There's still kind of socially a sense of self. But the way it operates is apparently significantly different. So self-state integration basically is putting the neurotic process into a different kind of order that is less afflicted with distress and confusion, more functional. And that kind of balance creates the foundation for liberation, the third category I talk about, self-state liberation, and that's the nirvana part. Buddhism emphasizes nirvana, but I think that there are several passages in the Pali Canon that talk about the benefits of the lay life, not being a renunciate and having a spiritual path. And there are examples of people who were awakened, even though they were workers, merchants, royalty, so forth and so on. Then there's the fourth noble truth, which is the Noble Eightfold Path. That's the ways and means for realizing the third noble truth. That I'm going to talk about during at least one future talk, the neuroscience associated with the Noble Eightfold Path. It's way complicated. There have actually been times when I took a whole year to talk about the Noble Eightfold Path and Dharma talks, and I was the only person giving Dharma talks at that time. So it's a very rich field for exploration, and a lot of it's posted online if you're willing to go to the website and dig around there and listen to the Dharma talks and see the notes that I posted. So now I'm going to talk about the neuroscience associated with dukkha. There's an area in the brain called the limbic system. It's situated between the brain stem, which basically what keeps us breathing and metabolizing food and so forth and so on, and the cerebral cortex, the outer layers of the brain. That has an important function in terms of dukkha. Within this system, well, first of all, let me digress a bit. A lot of the research that I've done involves what are called neural networks. Neural networks are systematic interconnections between neurons in basically describable areas of the brain. For example, I just described the limbic system. Within the limbic system, there's the amygdala, which is a cluster of neurons that basically function as part of what's called the salience network. There are other neural clusters and pathways that are involved with that as well. But basically, the function of this part of the brain is to be alert for novelty and make a very quick, incomplete assessment. Friend or foe, food or poison. And the way we experience that is if you, well, I'll use another example I've used many times. There's a story in Buddhism about how you are walking down a path late at night, it's not well lit, and you see this curvy shape, tubular shape on the ground. Instinctually, the first thing that pops into awareness, this is the amygdala, that's a snake. The amygdala connects to the hippocampus, which connects to other parts of the brain and assembles this flash of perception. It's a snake. Now, the benefit of something like mindfulness is that the reactivity to such a stimulus recognizes the incompleteness of that initial analysis and doesn't immediately impulsively react. And upon further information gathering and processing, no, it's not a snake, it's a piece of rope. Right? That's an important distinction to be able to make. And the salience network is very much involved with that. So, friend or foe, food or poison, part of what goes on during that interval regarding what that is, a snake or a piece of rope, is what's called the default mode network. And we are immersed in it. It's the daydreaming self. I call it the selfing story. We all have some kind of ongoing internal commentary that conjures up the self based on what's going on in these different areas of the brain simultaneously, just kind of pops up on the screen. For anyone who might be interested to understand more about this, I did a Dharma talk some years ago, well, fairly recently actually, on what's called Paticca-samuppada, which is dependent origination. But the article is titled Contingent Provisional Emergence. It's my understanding of how the self operates in an ongoing way. And so the ability to bring attention, mindfulness, to the default mode network and to that jumping to conclusions part that I mentioned about snake or rope, right? That's a really important part of Buddhist training, is to be able to investigate what the mind is creating with less and less impulsive reactivity. So how is that done? Well, the front part of the brain, the preorbital cortex or prefrontal lobes of the brain, has what's called the central executive network. Its function is to keep in mind, so to speak, what's going on, basically mindfulness, and either authorize activation, that is a snake, or authorize deactivation, that's a piece of rope. Interestingly enough, part of that sorting, evaluating, and regulating process, it might be a snake. But knowing that it's a snake and having the skills to deal skillfully with the snake, no harm to you, no harm to the snake, right? So this whole process is observing your own internal state in an ongoing way. And when the central executive network, the CEN, kicks into pack option action, then that's called the ta task positive network. I'll be talking more about that in a little bit, because that has a lot to do with craving and attachment right there. Repetitive negative thought patterns, rumination and worry, are associated with some kind of dysfunctional interaction between the salience network, default mode network, central executive network, because the mind is not adequately tracking that formative process. That's what mindfulness, Vipassana insight practice, is meant to cultivate. So, the second noble truth, craving attachment in the brain reward system. Craving, attachment, and ignorance are the key elements there. Or sometimes it's called greed, identification, and ignorance. Or desire, or what's the other term? Clinging. So, how does that operate? First, I'm going to talk about craving. How does that system operate? The word tanha, by the way, is an unquenchable thirst. That's what that means in Pali. The word tanha means unquenchable thirst. I mentioned affect before, I think, in this talk. An affect is the felt sense of impulsive reactivity or urgency. It can either be strongly pleasant, mildly pleasant, neutral, mildly unpleasant, strongly unpleasant. In psychological terms, a couple of terms are affect approach, if it's something you like, affect avoidance, if it's something you don't like, whether it's a something in the world or just what's going on in your mind. But there's a quality of self-identification. I hate that. I love that. There's a kind of process going on, an affective process of aversion or desire. But they're just impersonal things that go on in the parts of the brain that are associated with the amygdala, the desire. So I just want to be really clear about that. When we talk about desire from a Buddhist perspective, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're lusting after something. It might mean that you fear and hate something. It's that affective process. For example, in terms of those networks I was talking about, the salience network stimulates attention to something, friend or foe, food or poison. And then the story that's derived from parts of the brain that store memory, there's this very complex and kind of incredible storage facility capacity that we have in our brains. It's amazing how we can remember things, how many things we remember, and how many skills we have. They're also part of memory. What happens is in this process, the salience network and the default mode network are reverberating back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. There's an initial impulse, pleasant impulse. The mind kind of, brain kind of sorts through all the possible options, meanings of that in the storage bank that kind of associated with the default mode network. And as it goes through here, it becomes a first impression, second impression, third impression, fourth impression, on and on and on, reiterating this stimulation and pattern recognition and meaning making. And it kind of builds up in a fraction of a second. This happens multiple times a second. Neuroscience substantiates this, and Buddhism's been talking about this for millennia, how quickly the mind changes, how quickly the self changes. So this reiterative process, salience network, default mode network, starts to build a case for ego gratification. There's desire there, but the lack of the ability, lack of training to objectively observe this, to be mindful of it, is what ignorance is. And that's an essential part of the struggle. So this process builds a self, and the selfing story is the default mode network. And that signal goes to the central executive network, which is basically in the forebrain, the area above the eyes. And interestingly enough, when they first started doing research on this 30 or so years ago, there was an awareness that a person who's generally in an unhappy state will have predominant left preorbital activity in the brain, that kind of area kind of lights up. A person who's feeling joy, satisfaction, happiness, the right preorbital network starts, part of the brain starts to light up. It's one of the first important insights that they made when they started using functional MRI to explore mental states. Sidebar. A fellow named Richie Davidson, who was one of the people who really originated this research, was meeting with the Dalai Lama, a bunch of people were. And what Richardson was doing was investigating depression, anxiety and depression. And they realized there's left preorbital dominance, right? The Dalai Lama simply said, "Well, have you ever studied what goes on when a person is happy? When a person is joyful? Wow, what a great idea." So Richie Davidson started doing that. And that's where this notion came in about, well, first of all, how neuroscience can be associated with what goes on in Buddhist meditation. But also this sense of we know how the brain conditions itself. We're getting more and more information that's contemporary rather than based on the Pali Canon. So, central executive network receives a signal from the default mode network, and there's a gating function. Either, a go, no go kind of process. And that signal goes down to part of the brain in the limbic system, very closely associated with the amygdala, called the nucleus accumbens. And that's the part of the brain that turns the on switch for action, strongly associated with addiction. Person has an addictive problem, it's sort of stuck in the on position. That's the whole notion of tanha, unquenchable thirst. That's what craving is. It's just the nature of addiction that amplifies it, makes it really predominant. But it's going on for all of us, this gating function, the go, no go. We can become mindful of that. Back to the story about the snake and the rope. I went on a retreat in Tampa. As I was leaving the house, I stepped out on the porch, and there was a black snake on the porch, wiggling and trying to find its way out. I opened the door, and the snake went out. Okay, drove over to Tampa, got to the retreat center, got set up, was walking around the property, and looked down, and I immediately realized that snake rope thing. There was this sinuous figure buried under the leaves. My mind immediately jumped to snake. Immediately after that, and I was mindful of this because I was walking mindfully. No, it's a piece of insulated electrical wire that had been buried and was partly uncovered. That was a real revelation. It really helped me understand because I already knew about the amygdala and the nucleus accumbens and preorbital cortex and all that. So that was a really useful validation of what the teaching says. You develop enough insight and your reactivity level is sufficiently diminished. You're not impulsive in your reaction, and you're jumping to conclusions. You have more time to assess whether acting on this particular thought is beneficial or not. Very important skill set. Okay. That's what I'm going to say about craving. Next one is attachment. The word is upadana. It's an interesting word. It's translated as create attachment or clinging. But what it originally meant in the time of the Buddha, the Brahmin priests, their assignment was to keep a sacred fire burning. And the fuel for the fire was upadana. One of the signifiers of enlightenment of nirvana is what happens when the fire of craving and clinging, or craving and attachment, the fuel for that is gone. So Upadana is fuel. Functionally, what it really means is that that reiterated process I was talking about a few minutes ago, because the mind is not paying attention, ignorance, the mind gets attached to a particular view, particular identity, particular plan of action without further analysis and impulsively reacts, right? That preoccupation, that building a case I alluded to a short while ago, that's upadana. So Buddhist psychology identifies four forms of upadana: attachment to pleasant or unpleasant sensory stimulation. Second one, attachment to a view or belief. Third one, attachment to more or less flexible patterned behaviors. In strictly classical Buddhist terms, attachment to rites and rituals. Now, there was a reference in the time of the Buddha to Brahmanism, and there were certain rites and rituals. And if they were performed perfectly with the right intention, they would get the predicted results, right? So those are rites and rituals. The Buddha came along and said, nah, it doesn't work that way. We have certain behaviors that we do that may or may not be beneficial. It's the degree to which attachment to that particular approach or behavior or routine becomes rigid and maladaptive. That's what we're investigating and trying to learn how to manage. And then the final level of attachment is the belief that there's an enduring and autonomous self. Now, I'm giving you conceptual information. That's very useful. I've been doing a lot of reading on non-self and on emptiness lately. The trick of the thing is, you might have the concept and understand it, but you have to have the direct experience for liberation to actually happen. There's something that goes on, still pretty mysterious for me, but I'm looking at it. There's something that goes on in the process of awakening that just simply, the notion of there being a self and an object of duality kind of fades out. There's just suchness. There's a quality of present awareness that's unconditioned. There's no ego gratification or ego denial. There's not even any sense of there being an observing ego. There's just suchness. In fact, after his awakening, the Buddha didn't call himself the Buddha. He didn't call himself anything other than the Tathagata in the third person. The translation that I like about Tathagata is one who has mastered suchness. There's lots of different derivations of that, but that's what works for me. One that has mastered suchness. So that's what upadana is. It's this quality of concretizing or attachment, clustering together of these different beliefs about the world and about the self. And that's combined with the craving is what creates dukkha. So the next attribute to study here is avijja. It's a Pali word for ignorance. It's a deficiency in the ability to identify and regulate this formative and activating process. We are living it every moment. So I mentioned earlier in the talk that ignorance means on one level, you don't know how to do it. You know, I'm very ignorant about computer programming. I just don't know how to do it. It doesn't make sense to me. But the other aspect is delusional, not really paying attention. being biased, right? Because of craving and clinging. That's what ignorance is. So one of the major training aspirations in this practice is to train the mind to be more alert. I have it here. I think so. But on the wall in the other room, there's a something on a sheet of paper. It's a diligent, mindful, clearly knowing. It's there because when I meditate here, I go on retreat here, I see that. I'm looking here at my little podium, and I usually keep a copy of that here, but I don't see it right now. It's a basic training paradigm in Buddhism. Being diligent means really being committed, not with gritted teeth, but with active interest. Mindful, obviously, being self-aware. Clearly knowing, which is observing things, overcoming ignorance, seeing things as they really are. And when, things meaning how the mind creates a self. See it happening. That's the goal. So, the other thing it's important to understand about avidya is that it is antisocial. An important part of Buddhist training is virtue. I'll be talking about that when I'm talking about the Noble Eightfold Path. Right speech, right action, right livelihood. There's something about human interactions. We are social animals that benefits, society benefits, and individual benefits that come from speaking in ways that are not hurtful, that are truthful, that are supportive, behaving in ways that are not harmful. And cultivating a lifestyle that supports that. That's pro-social action. And that's also, you know, avidya prevents us from doing that. Obviously, humanity has a lot more work to do in that regard these days. So, because of that lack of training, we kind of stumble on through life and bounce from one distressful moment to another. That's self-state conflict. If all I get out of my dedicated meditation practice, which I've been doing for half my life now, is more peace of mind, more clarity, and more capability for being socially beneficial. Interpersonally beneficial, it's worth it. It's worth it. Interestingly enough, a 20th century intellectual said something about the importance of Buddhism for humanity. Arnold Toynbee. Coming of Buddhism to the West may well prove to be the most important event of the 20th century. He said that's early in the 20th century. Here we are, 100 years later, still working on it. Still working on it. So that's the second noble truth. The third noble truth is liberation from dukkha and the neurological gating networks. I've kind of been talking about that already. Liberation. It has three stages, moving from self-state conflict to self-state integration to self-state liberation. Now, I'm not saying that there's a steady state. It's not like I'm gonna, you know, travel north and I'm gonna leave Orange County and I go further north and I'm gonna leave Florida and enter Georgia. No. What it means is that, the movement toward awakening is incremental. When I get all twisted around myself, my self-state conflict, when, with my practice and other modalities, but with my practice, when that clears up and, you know, my behaviors are thoughtful and considerate, compassionate, so forth and so on, that moment is liberated from dukkha to an extent, right? So it occurs situationally, but we're training for that effect. That's what the whole notion of having a path means. That's what right livelihood means, is being intentional about coordinating the activity of these different neural pathways in ways that are emotionally wholesome and socially beneficial. I'm going to be talking about this more specifically when I talk about the Noble Eightfold Path. But functionally, what it means is that one of the ways to describe here, I'll read it to you. I think I have it here. Yeah. I have been using ChatGPT. I'm a very well-informed student of Buddhist doctrine. I know how to write the right questions into the program. And it's given me really nice summary answers about neuroscience and Buddhism. I'm really delighted with how well it's working. So in terms of this gating process, I mentioned it earlier. The preorbital cortex has an on switch and an off switch, kind of. Now, one might be tempted to think that, oh yeah, that's where the genie lives in the bottle. No. It's just a gating process, right? Just like one chamber of the heart has one process and another chamber of the heart has another process, but it's still all the heart. Same thing is true with the brain. Different parts of the brain have different processes operating simultaneously and influencing each other, out of which comes the notion of a self. So the ability to observe this requires developing a more sophisticated gating mechanism. It's pretty well known that a person who dedicates, you know, practices in a dedicated way, mindfulness and breathing meditation, the function of the default mode network, the impact of it, the driving force of it diminishes. The way I understand it, some of you have heard me say this many times, started out, there was this demon on my shoulder screaming in my ear. I had to listen to it and I had to do what it told me to do. That's the default mode network and my own neurotic impulse, right? Now the demon's in the other room. Now I find times when the demon's still chattering away over there. I don't care. It doesn't matter to me. I'm not that interested. If I was interested, I would know that there's this little story running over there, but it's just not that engaging. That's called viraga, dispassion. That's part of what goes on in this process of liberation, is the gating process diminishes the conviction of this default mode network, the selfing story. And it also develop stronger ways to operate the go, no-go function of the nucleus accumbens. So you can be aware of an urge. It's just there, just in the other room with the voice. I can ride it out, right? I can just be aware that there's an urge. Don't have to react on it. Or if I do act on it, I'm mindful when I act on it. And what I mean by that is I can be, this salience network could be cooking, right? And notice, I might be noticing that my mind is starting to build some kind of drama inside. And I can start to feel it in my body. And I may or may not be successful at immediately pulling the plug on it. But I'm aware, oh, this is suffering. This is dukkha. And this is the expectation in this mind about how things should be compared to what's actually happening. Right? That's how this works. So the default mode network loses its volume and its ability to convince, and the action network has more discipline. Shyla Catherine, one of my teachers, calls it the potent pause. I call it the buffer. I have this ability to notice my mind. Oh, that's a snake. No, it's a piece of insulated wire. I have that capacity to catch what's happening in the mind in an ongoing way. That's what awakening is about. And it moves the structure of the mind from self-state conflict to self-state integration. I still might have my difficult times, but in my view, they're what a brain does. I'm not a terrible person, or I'm not a hero. This is just what's going on in this brain at this time. It's like watching a movie. In fact, when I do self-retreats in this building, I don't sleep very much. And it's not because, I'm awake all the time. I just, when I go down to sleep, my body and mind goes into a zone of what's called lucid dreaming. So I've decided it's like in my own movie. And I don't know how the plot's going to play out, but isn't it interesting? That's the kind of quality of detached investigative interest that comes with dedicated practice. And that's what promotes awakening. Okay. Third noble truth, nirvana. It has different characteristics. First of all, here's what's difficult about nirvana is it's unconditioned. But how we attribute it in terms of words, it's a cessation of craving, attachment, and suffering. It's a loss of a constructed self perspective, anatta. It's timeless, spaceless, and unconditioned. And it's often described as ineffable, beyond sensory or cognitive fabrication. The classic kind of terminology. Okay, so now this is in the notes. I just basically copied and pasted into this document the answer to the question about what happens in the various networks in the experience of nirvana. Now, this is very speculative. They've actually had people, when I first started meditating, I thought this, experience of awakening is something that happened, once in 1,000 years. I'm sure there are thousands, if not tens of thousands, of people walking around the planet right now who are experiencing awakening, and not all of them Buddhist. Not all of them Buddhist. It's just a quality of present moment being that's unafflicted. Default mode network is deactivated. Self-referential thought and autobiographical narrative go away. And there's an entry into non-dual awareness. There's no more in the awareness, there's no subject object. There's no observer. There's nothing being observed. There's just suchness. The salience and interoceptive network shifts. Deep states, the body-self boundaries weaken. And there's a disengagement from conflict monitoring. Conflict monitoring basically means there's no need for argument or conflict or distress or confusion. In the what's called the thalamocortical gating part. The thalamus is a part of the brain. It's in the base part of the brain. It just basically is kind of a transfer station for signals going from the body to the brain, from the brain to the body, and so forth and so on, in different areas of the brain. This process is offline, basically. And the prefrontal area, the central executive network, is also offline. There's just no felt need to identify there being a separate self or an identifiable body. I've had experiences on retreats where my body became like a vibratory zone, a sensory experience, and trying to care about where the body leaves off and the rest of the universe begins, and whether sound is out there or just soundness, just drops away. Very interesting state. Doesn't happen very often now, but so I'm looking forward to my next self-retreat in December to explore that some more. There's a quality of timelessness, and timelessness basically means there's no need to consider a future or a past. It's just no, because that's future and past is part of the default mode network. There's no need for it. And a sense of balance and equanimity. So that's the experience of nirvana, non-duality, emptiness, different terminology there. And that's what I have to say about first three of the Four Noble Truths. And we have a few minutes for questions, if anyone has them, or comments.
So would you say that the neuroscience explain the spirituality?
I think neuroscience provides us with data that is scientific. In other words, the part of the brain in me that is associated with speech, typically the left temporal area, the part of the brain in you that does the same thing, they're the same. So there's that. And science can explain that. And so that's what's called the soft problem of consciousness. We know where different functions operate in different areas of the brain. The hard problem of consciousness is, how does that happen? How does that happen?
I think the hard problem consciousness is our sensing, our feeling.
There's that, yes.
Yeah, that's what the science cannot explain.
Exactly. That's what makes it a hard problem. The mind cannot explain the selfing story. I mean, science, excuse me, neuroscience cannot explain that in terms of the layout of the brain. And that's why it's hard. But spiritually, it can be resolved. I described it: self-state conflict, self-state integration, self-state liberation. And neurological research gives us more insight into how that operates. There have been other examples of neuroscience that I didn't want to dive into that support it as well. Other questions or comments? Yes, Steve.
It's a tricky thing, right, though, talking about the contingent provisional emergence or the non-self, because we all participate in a society in which we have to play the selfing game to some extent.
Yep.
And I wonder, is it a game one can play where they study this concept of non-self and they do the investigation so that they can play the selfing game better ultimately? Or are the teachings more centered around, well, no, keep going hardcore into the no-self thing so that you can just completely, have no stories or no attachments to anything? It seems like both things are good.
Yes. So the story from Buddhism that goes along with what you said, Steve, is that you can imagine that the Dharma, the principles and concepts and practices that we call Buddhism, is like a raft. And that would be the game, right? And you use the raft to cross the river of samsara, which is the river of dukkha, right? I talked about that reiterative process that just kind of keeps spinning and spinning and spinning and creating a self. That's what samsara is. The Buddha said, when you cross the river, once you get to the other side, you don't need to have the raft anymore. Now, if you go back to the other side, and by the way, that's another way to understand Tathagata, one who has gone there and come back to tell about it. So that's the association between game, playing a game, and the raft. You have certain skills, certain concepts that you work with, and they produce a beneficial effect.
It makes me think too about shadow work, like the Jung concept. I don't know if that's too far off, but
no, it's not.
You
it's
look into the
spot
darkness,
on.
You investigate all that. Then when the self comes back, it's lighter. There's hopefully less content of this self, less complex.
Well, the shadow is ignorance.
Yeah, that's what I thought when he said the ignorant part of ignorance.
Right.
Yeah, the ignore part of ignorance.
Yeah. From a Jungian perspective, what he was a psychoanalyst, but the shadow is that part of one's self-identification that we ignore, that is too painful or somehow incomplete or threatening or whatever. So we act in a particular way so that the shadow does not become evident. But often doing that makes things worse. Learning how to work through the shadow is one of the major goals of Jungian therapy. Other questions or comments?
I'm hoping that sometime you will get a chance to talk more about emptiness.
Well, the talk that I gave on the 4th of this month about neuroplasticity and non-self, that's equivalent to emptiness. Sunyata and anatta are synonymous. Sunyata is typically known as emptiness.
When emptiness means there's nothing, right? There's
no.
Nothing.
No,
it's
does
all,
not mean
all,
that.
It's all empty, yeah.
No. No, that's not what it means. What emptiness means is there is no separable thing in the universe. Everything is interconnected, interbeing. Thich Nhat Hanh called it interbeing.
What I understand is emptiness is there is nothing that forms, like it's just all drifting, shifting. It's all the time. It's there's nothing you can say is there. Like even you and I, we are changing every second.
Right.
You know, something like same like walk the river.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, but it does not mean. It's not nihilistic.
No.
The word emptiness is really awkward because it gives the notion of somehow interstellar space or nihilism or meaninglessness. Not that at all.
Yeah.
It's a difficult thing to understand. And I've studied it for many years and I'm really interested in it these days. Custom at the end of our meetings for us to sit together in silence for a brief interval. Let's do that. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well. I hope we're all reasonably safe and happy until the next time we have a chance to chat.